world awaits a response from Israel to Iran's weekend attack and assesses Tehran's intent.
Let me tell you something. You launch 300 missiles and drones, you're not sending a signal. You're trying to cause damage. You're trying to kill people. That was absolutely their intent.
John Kirby with the National Security Council ahead this hour. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. In Ukraine, the war is shifting in Russia's favor.
Based on my experience in 37 plus years in the U.S. military, if one side can shoot and the other side can't shoot back, the side that can't shoot back loses.
Also today, we follow the risky pathway migrants take across Mexico by foot, on trains, through difficult terrain.
And a Danish landmark ruined by fire.
It really rattles the Copenhagen self-image.
All that and more coming up on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Israel today called on dozens of nations to impose new sanctions on Iran's missile program. This comes after Tehran's first ever aerial attack from its soil directly at Israel. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, said his country will respond swiftly if Israel retaliates for the strike. Here he is speaking via an interpreter on Al Jazeera.
If the Israeli regime makes a mistake, this time Iran's response, as Iran's military commanders announced, will not be minimal, but immediate and severe.
Diplomats are calling on Israel to show restraint. Earlier today, I reached out to John Kirby at the White House. He's a spokesman for the National Security Council, which advises the president on security and foreign policy. I asked Kirby whether a retaliatory attack on Iran was an option Israelis were considering.
They have to make their own decisions and speak to their decisions. We don't want to see a war with Iran. We don't want to see this conflict widen and deepen. However, we will do what we have to do to help Israel with its self-defense, as we proved on Saturday night.
And the event that appears to have triggered Iran's attack on Saturday, that event in the first place, a missile strike on the Quds commander in Damascus, destroying the Iranian consulate, was the U.S. consulted on that? And from a security point of view, endangering an already volatile region, what are your thoughts about Israel making that move?
Well, without getting into the details of that particular strike, I won't do that. I would just say that the United States was not informed or involved in any way.
And concerns now about what that kind of decision might mean for the future?
Again, what we saw on Saturday night was unprecedented. I mean, more than 300 missiles and drones fired at Israel from Iran proper. There's no justification for that. There just isn't. It's completely unacceptable and condemnable. And in fact, we have condemned it, as has so many other leaders around the world.
As in many situations like this, a country's internal politics play a big role in what any response might be. And we're seeing this hard right coalition right now in Israel, a constant drumbeat from them to retaliate. Do you really think that Prime Minister Netanyahu could not retaliate and maintain his current political position?
So I can't speak to what pressures Prime Minister Netanyahu may be feeling from what quarters and how that's affecting his decision making. Look, the Israelis have said publicly that they intend to respond. They've said that they're going to do it in a manner and a time of their choosing. I'll let them speak to that. All I can speak to is what we're doing in the region and what President Biden's priorities are. And that is, again, to help Israel defend itself. And we are still doing that.
So you made a point of the successful show of defensive force on Saturday night, Iron Dome, and the taking out of the drones and missiles. But we should also note that Iran now has a very clear sense of Israel's defenses. So many drones and missiles were launched across Israeli territory. How crucial is that intel to Iran right now?
Well, look, I think there was some rumors coming out of the region, and Iran was sort of seeding it into the narrative that they meant to fail. We weren't really trying to do this and cause any real damage. We were just trying to send a signal. Let me tell you something. You launch 300 missiles and drones, you're not sending a signal. You're trying to cause damage. You're trying to kill people. That was absolutely their intent. It's not like they don't know that Israel has a very capable air defense system. Everybody in the region knows. Heck, everybody in the world knows. And they knew too. And that's one of the reasons they launched over 300 missiles and drones, because they knew that some of them weren't going to get through. But they knew or hoped that some of them would. I think they're probably a little bit surprised by how few actually got through and how little damage they caused. But believe me, they wanted to cause damage. This was not some symbolic effort. Now, as for the intel picture, again, I won't get into that publicly, and I certainly can't speak for what Iran thinks they know or they don't know. I'll tell you one thing that I'm confident they do know now. And that is that the United States, when we say we're going to help with the defense of Israel, we mean it. And we're putting skin in the game, literally putting skin in the game. And number two, I think they know that Israel does not stand alone in the region, that Israel has friends, friends that will come to their assistance.
John Kirby, let's go back to Gaza. You mentioned that a moment ago. What are the Israelis doing to end the war in Gaza?
Right now, we are all focused, and our Israeli counterparts, on trying to get those hostages out. And the way to do that is to get a six-week ceasefire in place so that those hostages can be safely moved. And that six-week ceasefire not only will bring the violence down, but it will help us increase the aid getting in, the humanitarian assistance.
I mean, there are mixed reports on how much aid and number of trucks getting into Gaza each day. Are you confident the Israeli officials are telling the truth?
We have independent ways of verifying the numbers that are getting in. We have a special envoy on the ground, David Satterfield, sends a daily update about what he's seeing through his conversations, not just with the Israelis, but with other counterparts in the region. So, yes, we're comfortable in the progress that we're seeing.
I've heard a lot of Israelis say over the past 2 weeks that Prime Minister Netanyahu is dragging out this war in Gaza for his own political survival. How true is that?
I can't speak to his political calculations or what he's thinking. Look, I think two things can be true at once. Israel is still under threat from Hamas. This is an organization that slaughtered 1,200 Israelis on the 7th of October. People forget there was a ceasefire in place on the 6th of October, and Mr. Sinwar decided to violate that and slaughtered 1,200 people. And the Israelis are right to want to eliminate that threat to their state and to their people. They have every right to go after Hamas. We would do the same thing. Now, it's the way they do it that we don't always agree with, the way they're prosecuting their operations. So the other thing that has to be true is you can go after this threat, legitimate threat, but do it in a way that preserves the sanctity of civilian life, that preserves the ability of aid organizations to get humanitarian assistance in, and preserves every scrap of effort and energy that we all have available to us to get those hostages home.
So there is a Gaza theater. There's also the post-Gaza theater. Meanwhile, the West Bank is exploding with the worst violence between settlers and Palestinians since October 7th. Hezbollah to the north and now Iran up front with some kind of retaliation in store for them. How much influence does the White House really have over so many variables under this prime minister?
I get this question all the time, and people gasp, you know, well, if they don't do everything you ask them to do, or they don't do it exactly the way that you ask them to do it, you have no influence, you have no leverage. The Israeli people know they can trust Joe Biden. They know that Joe Biden has been a Zionist his whole life, that he believes wholeheartedly in the state of Israel. And as a good friend of Israel, that means you've got to be able to have a tough conversation. I'm sure you have friends. I have friends. And the friends that we value the most are the ones that are honest with us, the ones that are not afraid to disagree with us. And that is the way Joe Biden feels about the government in Israel. And that's the way he feels about the state of Israel, that we are good friends and allies. And that is enduring. And he proved it on Saturday night. But it doesn't mean that we're not going to have those tough conversations with him about the way they're doing business.
Retired Admiral John Kirby is a spokesman for the National Security Council. He joined us from the White House.
Just a few months ago, U.S. border agents were trying to process 10,000 migrants wanting to cross into the U.S. from Mexico every day. That number is now significantly down since December, which is surprising because crossings typically rise in spring as it gets warmer. But as the world's Tibis Isaiah reports, it's not that the migrants stopped coming, it's that they're increasingly stuck in Mexico.
Huehuetoca is a rural village about 40 miles north of Mexico City. This place would go unnoticed if it wasn't for the hundreds of migrants who come here every day looking for a place known as El Basurero, or the landfill. El Basurero doesn't show up on most maps, but everyone here knows about it, so I ask for directions.
Ahí donde se ven esos arbolitos en esa lomita. Ahí es el basurero.
When I arrive, I see there is indeed a huge landfill with trucks and workers bringing in the garbage. The reason why migrants come here is to catch cargo trains going to the north of Mexico. The trains often stop here for several minutes to change tracks, and people jump on the roof and ride for 20 hours or more. Dozens of migrants are waiting for the next train. The schedule changes every day, and it's subject to mystery and speculation.
A las 3 más o menos dicen que pasa.
There's one coming at 3 p.m., says Andreina Rodriguez. She comes from Venezuela and is here with her daughter, Ashley, who's 6. And very excited about the train. Ashley sees riding the train as an adventure. But the adults are well aware of the dangers. There's the risk of falling and losing an arm or leg. There is hypothermia or heat stroke after being exposed to the elements for so many hours. But in recent months, the trains have become a preferred transportation mode for migrants headed to the U.S. And that's because the Mexican government started making it harder for undocumented migrants to cross the country on their way to the U.S. per request of the Biden administration. Rafael Velasquez is with the International Rescue Committee.
The National Authority for Migration has suspended providing humanitarian permits that allow for people to transit.
Without those permits, the migrants can't buy bus tickets. Truckers and other motorists face fines if they give rides to undocumented people. And there are immigration checkpoints along the highway and on public buses. In the first 2 months of the year, Mexico said it detained 3 times more migrants than the same period last year.
Toca caminar. Caminé. Toqué con suerte que también agarré algunos autobuses. No es fácil llegar hasta Ciudad de México.
Josmar García, another migrant from Venezuela in the landfill, says he had to walk for days and sometimes bribe police officers to board public buses and get to Mexico City. He was lucky because he had some money. Migrants who get caught without money are sent to the south of Mexico, which has its own dangers. Members of organized crime have set up operations there, and migrants are often robbed, kidnapped, and extorted. Andreina Rodriguez says Mexico has been the most difficult part of her journey.
Pero usted aquí en México, desde que pisa, usted está a que lo roben, a que lo secuestren, a que lo devuelvan.
She tells me she was advised to take birth control pills because rape is common in Mexico. By traveling on these trains, the migrants are hoping to avoid immigration authorities and cartel members. After waiting for 7 hours, a group of construction workers repairing the tracks yell that the train is finally coming. People grab their belongings and run to the train. Their faces show a mix of fear and excitement. The train stops for a few minutes to switch tracks, and the migrants climb up to the roof. Once they're there, they take selfies and wave at us. The next morning, I checked in with Josmar García and Andreina Rodriguez to see if they made it to the north of Mexico. They said immigration officials stopped the train about an hour after leaving the landfill.
Nos montaron en las combis, nos quitaron todo, celulares.
They forced the migrants off the train and onto a bus headed back to the south of Mexico, except for those who could pay bribes.
Le ofrecí dinero. Le ofrecí dinero y...
Josmar says he gave the officers everything he had, about $300, and they let him stay in the area. Now he's working in construction to save money and continue northward. Andreina did not have the money, and she was bussed back south with her daughter and the rest of the migrants. She told me that she's determined to reach the U.S. with her daughter, and they will cross Mexico as many times as it takes to get there. For the World, I'm Tibisa Isea in Mexico City.
You're listening to The World. You're with The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Smoke filled the Copenhagen skyline today when a fire broke out at the city's historic Stock Exchange building. It threatened art and valuables there and destroyed the building's iconic spire, which dates to the 1700s and looked like 4 intertwined dragon's tails. Many city residents are now lamenting the spire's loss. One of them is Mark Isett. He's a Swedish architecture critic living in Copenhagen.
It's a terribly sad, sad day here in Copenhagen. It's probably the most iconic piece of architecture that the city has. I've been down there looking at the fire, and it's just totally quiet. Everybody's just standing there with their telephones, photographing and filming what is happening. And the spire was these four dragons standing on their front paws and twisting their tails up towards the sky, towards the three crowns symbolizing Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, which was the union back in the 17th century.
What did the dragon tails themselves represent?
The four dragons were there, paradoxically, to fend off fire. The fire-breathing dragons were there for that cause, and they managed to do that job for more than 400 years. But it didn't work all the way to the end, unfortunately.
You said you were down there earlier today. Can you tell me more of what it looked like and whether there were folks there gathered to kind of mourn this piece of architecture?
There was certainly mourning in the air, definitely. When I came, there was mostly smoke, but about half an hour later, there were flames going up through the roof. And today, half the building is in ruins. The roof is all gone, and merely the walls are standing in half of this 17th century building.
Is it known what caused the fire?
One doesn't know, but I mean, it was 5 years ago, almost on the day that Notre Dame was hit by the same fates, and that was refurbished, and this was being refurbished as well. So there is definitely need to look at the precautions one take when one does refurbishment in these historic buildings, that's for sure. But that's a debate which will come within the next couple of days and weeks, I think.
Sure. I understand that firefighters and even folks off the street went in and worked to save some art and valuables that were stored inside the historic building. Do you know what was saved and what might have gone up in flames? What all was there?
Well, I think the major art pieces in that half of the building that has been burnt down have been saved. But then I know that they have a very substantial library with leather-bound books, and I don't think that those books have been able to be saved. So that's a great loss. And one has to remember, too, that this is the Chamber of Commerce, and this very, very small country with merely 5 million inhabitants have always been totally focused on trade. That's where their self-image, their self-identity lies in many ways.
Do you think that this spire will be rebuilt?
Yes, I hope it will be rebuilt. And I think it will, because the tower that toppled today, or the spire that toppled today, wasn't the actual tower that was put in place in 1625. This was a one that was put in place in 1775. So since they managed to recreate the original in 1775, I think definitely that we should be able to recreate it today.
Mark Isett is a Swedish architecture critic and a resident of Copenhagen.
Anger management is a big concern in business and in our personal lives. Venting your anger by doing some kind of physical activity is a popular choice. There are even businesses that encourage aggression in a safe space.
Rage rooms are rooms where you basically pay to go and smash objects, either that is TVs or silverware or cups and everything, basically in a normal household.
Sophie Chavich is lead author on a new study that says venting your rage is not an effective way to reduce anger.
No, actually, it's the opposite, because when you're expressing your anger, you're practicing aggression.
So what techniques are shown to actually work best at reducing anger?
So when you are angry, you are very physically aroused. And so the things to do when you're angry is to reduce that arousal in your body. And so doing activities such as muscle relaxation, mindfulness, meditation, or yoga are effective strategies for reducing arousal or anger.
So again, your study, which you conducted at the Ohio State University, analyzed data from 154 different studies across cultures around the globe. What role did cultural difference play in how people cope with anger?
We looked at the difference between collectivistic and individualistic cultures. So countries in Asia and the US or Western Europe. And there wasn't really a difference at all.
And so what does that tell us?
It tells us that regardless of where in the world you're born, reducing arousal is the way to go in order to reduce anger.
So you grew up in Norway and studied psychology in Oslo, I see. In your experience, did you find any differences between Norway and, say, the United States, where, you know, rage rooms have become quite popular?
No, there wasn't actually any difference between European countries and the U.S.
I know, you know, most of us have lost our temper at one time or another. There's also that urging an angry person to calm down can have the opposite effect. What did your research tell you about reducing arousal in others?
We didn't actually look at how to reduce arousal in other people. I think a better way to go than to tell someone to calm down, even though that is the best way to reduce anger, is to show sympathy and show that everyone gets angry and it's okay to get angry, but that there's other ways of dealing with it than expressing it.
Now that you've shown that venting your anger is not effective at reducing it, are there other questions around anger you want to explore next?
I'm very interested in exploring more the aspect of different activities that increase arousal. So we found a huge difference between activities that increases physiological arousal. We found that, for example, jogging was very negative and could actually increase anger.
Why?
Well, we think that jogging increases anger because it's a monotone and boring activity where you have time to ruminate in addition to inducing physiological arousal.
So our show producer is really into ultramarathons. If you're doing something that's super focused like that, is there a possibility that can reduce anger?
We didn't find that the length of the activity impacted the outcome. However, it might be that he's not necessarily running when he's angry. That she's not running when she's angry.
Sophie, are there sports or other activities that do help with reducing that arousal that leads to anger?
Yes, we did find that, for example, ball sports and physical education classes are effective at reducing anger. And we think that is because they introduce an aspect of play, which can induce positive emotions. They also include social interactions with other people, which will also induce more positive emotions.
That's Sophie Chavich, a postdoctoral fellow at the Injury and Violence Prevention Program at Virginia Commonwealth University. Her study, co-authored with Brad Bushman at The Ohio State University, is published in the journal Clinical Psychology Review. You're with the world.
The battle is on between the U.S. and China for influence among Pacific Island nations.
Some people have gone as far as calling Solomon Islands a new Cuba off the coast of Australia, which is kind of ridiculous.
A new Cold War in the Pacific. Also, rising sea temperatures are killing coral around the globe. And awaiting military aid in Ukraine, still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For months now, the Biden administration has been urging Congress to pass a bill that would provide significant military aid to Ukraine. The Senate passed a bill worth tens of billions of dollars back in February, but ever since, it's been held up in the House. Yesterday, despite pushback from some Republican colleagues, Speaker Mike Johnson said he plans to advance an aid bill for a vote, along with other national security spending packages.
We have terrorists and tyrants and terrible leaders around the world like Putin and Xi and in Iran, and they're watching to see if America will stand up for its allies and in our own interests around the globe, and we will.
It's still unclear, though, whether the package will pass. Meanwhile, government officials in the U.S. and Ukraine are warning that the delay in military aid is already having an impact on the battlefield. From Riga, Latvia, the world's Daniel Hoffman reports.
Top U.S. military leaders were unequivocal last week while testifying before the House.
The severity of this moment cannot be overstated. If we do not continue to support Ukraine, Ukraine could lose.
That's General Christopher Cavoli. He's the head of U.S. European Command and is also NATO's Supreme Allied Commander on the continent. He's not known for mincing words.
Based on my experience in 37-plus years in the U.S. military, if one side can shoot and the other side can't shoot back, the side that can't shoot back loses. So the stakes are very high.
According to General Cavoli, Ukraine is being outgunned by Russia. Yuri Sak, an advisor to the Minister of Strategic Industries in Ukraine, agrees.
The major concern on the front lines at the moment is the lack of artillery, lack of ammunition. And if the situation doesn't change very soon, we are likely to be in a position where the ratio will be 6-1.
That is, for every 6 artillery shells that Russia fires, Ukraine will only be able to respond with 1. In his testimony, General Kavoli said that if Ukraine isn't properly supplied, that ratio could jump to 10 to 1 within a matter of weeks. Russia isn't only firing on military targets. It's intensified its bombing campaign against Ukraine's civilian infrastructure as well. Just last week, Russia destroyed Ukraine's largest coal power plant near Kyiv.
More than 40 missiles and 40 drones were used in the attack.
Ukrainian officials say at least 200,000 people are now without power.
Ukraine's president has warned the country is fast running out of air defenses and artillery to fend off Russian attacks.
Sergei Grabsky, a retired Ukrainian colonel and military expert, says Ukraine is increasingly exposed as it waits for more support from the United States.
Since the beginning of this invasion, Ukraine is under permanent pressure of airstrikes from the territory of the Russian Federation. No one in our civilization suffered from such an intensive attacks of different types of air armament.
Grabsky says that compared to the beginning of the war, Ukraine's air defense capabilities have improved, thanks in part to the Patriot missile system provided by the U.S. But Grabsky says that Ukraine is a huge country, and with Russia's ongoing attacks, it needs a lot more to defend itself.
We as Ukrainian citizens suffering now from the lack of anti-aircraft ammunition, mostly missiles, because of to protect the territory of the country, which is the biggest by the territory in Europe. Even 25 anti-aircraft complex such as Patriot would not be enough, I am afraid.
Military experts in Ukraine point out yet another challenge facing the country's war effort, a shortage in troops.
It's now more than 2 years. In that period of time, you understand that some of the troops need to be rotated.
This is Yuri Sak again.
There are losses on our side as well, so we need to mobilize more soldiers so that we can carry out these rotations.
Ukraine's parliament recently passed a law that lowers the draft age from 27 to 25. The aim is to mobilize more troops to fill those gaps along the front lines. But despite the shortages, both in ammunition and personnel, Sak says that from his conversations with troops, morale is still high.
Very often, even when we speak to those soldiers who have been fighting for now more than 2 years, and they're tired, but they're still determined. And it cannot be any other way because everybody understands what's at stake. For us, it's a war of survival. We understand that, you know, there is no other choice for us but to continue to fight until we win.
Retired Colonel Sergei Grabsky says it's in the interests of the U.S. and other allies to help with that effort. If Russia's military isn't stopped, it will expand beyond Ukraine and drag NATO into war.
If Russians will win in Ukraine, the United States will pay not only money to support their allies in Europe, which they must do, but also they will pay the life of their soldiers.
Grabsky emphasizes that Ukrainians haven't asked anyone to fight for them. He says they just need the means to defend themselves.
Our guys are exhausted. Our guys are tired. I am talking about all of them, commanders, officers, soldiers. But no one, literally no one, say we will give up and we will withdraw just to leave our country. No way. We will continue our battle. Ukraine will resist until the last soldiers will fall.
For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Riga, Latvia.
As you just heard, Russia has been targeting Ukrainian energy infrastructure, including the largest power plant in the Kyiv region, which Russian missiles knocked out last week. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on PBS NewsHour last night that the military was only able to shoot down 7 of the 11 missiles targeting the plant.
Чому? Тому що було ракет нуль. У нас закінчились всі ракети, які захищали Трипілля.
Why, Zelensky asked? Because we had 0 rockets. We ran out of rockets that were defending the power plant. Andrian Prokop is in Kyiv. He's head of the energy program at the Ukrainian Institute for the Future. He told me earlier today that damage is extensive.
Well, actually, about 85% of thermal power plants and 50% of big hydropower plant capacities are damaged. And this actually complicates a lot balancing the power system. So as of now, Ukraine is deeply dependent on importing electricity from Europe afternoon and on solar power plants in the morning and noon.
Mm. You said 85% of thermal power plants, so things like coal-fired power plants, are damaged. Does that mean there is no power coming out of all of those plants, or just reduced power?
That is a serious drop in production, and sure, there is a threat that these may be again damaged by some Russian missiles or Shahed drones.
So you're in Kyiv. I'm wondering how daily life in Kyiv has been impacted since last Thursday's attack. How many people are without power right now?
In Kyiv and in most of other big cities, we haven't experienced cutoffs yet.
And what about Kharkiv? All three of the main power plants that serve that city have been destroyed. How is that city coping?
Yeah, the situation is in Kharkiv the most difficult. And besides that, all power plants in Kharkiv are damaged or destroyed. Also, Russians tried to destroy transmission infrastructure, which actually helps to supply electricity from other regions to Kharkiv. But there is no understanding what will be the situation in future, especially when talking about the following winter.
You said cut off. So there's parts of the day where there's no power to people in Kharkiv.
Right.
You mentioned just how much of energy generation is damaged. Is there a sense of what percentage of power is being produced now versus pre-war levels?
Power consumption has fallen by 30%. So I would say that now consumption is about 10-15% less than it was a year ago when we already didn't see these power cutoffs. But in late 2022, in some days, power consumption was about even 45% less compared to the days before the invasion.
Have repairs been able to keep pace with damage over the past 2+ years of war, or are the damages just kind of piling up now?
No, we have saw very good campaigns of repairing. For example, in winter 2022-2023, the whole country experienced serious cutoffs. But in 2023, we almost forgot what power cutoffs are. So Ukrainian energy companies, together with the support of Ukraine's allies, did a great job in repairing. But now we are facing the situation similar we had in late 2022.
How do you get equipment and materials to repair the power plants?
Well, this is the most difficult question because most of this equipment is very unique equipment that is produced by request. And some facilities are old-fashioned and it's pretty difficult to find these spare parts. The other problem that Western banks and companies do not finance renovation of coal-fired thermal power plants. So this all creates additional challenges for Ukraine to repair the power system.
Mm. So is the only real solution here for Ukraine to be supplied with more munitions so that they can defend power plants? Or are there other things that the government or military could be doing to shore up the energy supply?
So the key solution is to have more air defense systems. And we have to try to repair as much facilities as possible by the winter and build new decentralized generation. Mostly this is about small-scale gas-fired power generation to be prepared to the next winter.
Andreyan Prokhyp is head of the energy program at the Ukrainian Institute for the Future, based in Kyiv.
And now let's catch you up on a few bits of Olympics news today.
The flame that will burn at the Summer Olympics in Paris was lit today at the site of the ancient games in Olympia in southern Greece. Torchbearers will carry that flame throughout the Greek islands for 11 days before it heads to France next month.
In Paris, the grand plans for the opening ceremony need a backup plan, says French President Emmanuel Macron. The spectacle that opens the games would have athletes floating down the River Seine through Paris with fans cheering from riverbanks. Security concerns have already scaled back the number of spectators allowed. Now, Macron says the ceremony will move to a stadium if the security threat is deemed too high.
And finally, here in the U.S., Olympic organizers announced a new program today that will help athletes figure out their lives after they've said goodbye to sports. Around 60% of Olympic athletes under the age of 40 say they needed help with career and professional development. The new program opens college and certification programs for those athletes, along with career counseling.
And that's your Olympics Roundup for today.
The Solomon Islands, to the northeast of Australia, consist of 6 major islands and over 900 smaller ones. It is a small country, about the size of Hawaii, but it's caught up in a very big geopolitical game, a competition between China and the U.S. over who will have influence among Pacific Island nations. Tomorrow, Solomon Islanders will voice their opinion on that game when they cast their ballots for the next prime minister. The current leader is pro-Beijing and is expected to win over the opposition leader, who leans toward the West. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare has a message for voters. America is not all it's cracked up to be.
Go to New York, you go to Chicago, you go to every major city of the United States of America. You see beggars sitting on the street. That's supposed to be number one economy of the world.
As for China, Sogavare says China's streets are much nicer.
And I tell you, a striking thing that I'm up, you don't see beggars.
Sogavare, 69 years old, is in his 4th term as the Solomon Islands prime minister. Tomorrow's election determines if he will serve a 5th. Solomon Islanders have pressing problems at home. High unemployment, limited health care, bad roads. And Sogavare is not uniformly popular. Riots broke out when he was declared the winner of the previous election. So, why is their leader talking so much about foreign superpowers?
What he's saying is, look at what China can do and what China has done that the U.S. has not been able to do.
Professor Tarcisius Kabutaulaka is a political scholar and a Solomon Islander, now at the University of Hawaii. In recent years, China has doted on the Solomon Islands. It's built a massive stadium. It's now constructing a modern hospital. China has also brought Sogavare to Beijing to meet leader Xi Jinping. What has the West done for this small nation? Well, Australia, about 1,000 miles away, is still the country's biggest aid donor, giving more than $100 million a year.
But the issue is, it is not as visible as the big Chinese developments like stadiums.
Kabutaulaka says Australia's aid is less flashy. It's vaccines, job training, programs to end gender imbalances on the islands. Whatever the West has given so far, Sogavare has told voters, it's not enough.
We have been shouting in the wilderness for development since 1978.
That's when the Solomon Islands became a country. It was a British colony, managed from Australia. And there's still bitterness around that colonial legacy. Today, the United States looks to Australia to keep the Solomon Islands and other small Pacific countries aligned with the West. Former Australian Prime Minister John Howard infamously said, Australia is like the region's deputy sheriff, a view endorsed by former U.S. President George W. Bush. That statement came out more than 2 decades ago. But Professor Kabutaulaka says it still sticks in the minds of many Pacific Islanders.
The U.S. is the sheriff. The U.S. is the higher power. And Australia is the deputy sheriff in this particular part of the world.
Whether accurate or not, he says, any whiff of this attitude can be grating.
It rubs off in the wrong way with Pacific Island countries.
Chinese state media poke at these sensitivities, saying the U.S. wants to bully the Solomon Islands. But until recently, America mostly ignored the country. Then, 2 years ago, Sogavare signed a deal allowing Chinese police and troops to temporarily deploy to the islands, if the prime minister requests it. The U.S. and Australia have been riled up ever since, says Terrence Wood. He's a research fellow at Australian National University's Development Policy Center.
Some people have gone as far as calling Solomon Islands a new Cuba off the coast of Australia, which is kind of ridiculous.
What's not ridiculous, he says, is the fact that every single Pacific nation, no matter how small, is now getting a lot more focus from Washington and Beijing.
The West and China have certainly stumbled into a new Cold War in the Pacific.
It's not that Sogavare wants to cut ties with the U.S. Wood says the prime minister wants to play the West and China off each other to get more perks from both sides. For more than 3 decades, the U.S. didn't even have an embassy in the Solomon Islands. But last year, it rushed to open one. Sogavare says that is a direct result of him making friends with China. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll start with the good climate news. The global effort to get more renewable energy projects built saw some progress in the past year. The Global Wind Energy Council reported today that 117 gigawatts of new wind energy projects were installed in 2023. That is a 50% increase over the year before.
China built the most wind power capacity, followed by the U.S., Brazil, and Germany. Africa and the Middle East saw record growth. The report notes major upcoming projects in South Africa, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia that will significantly increase those countries' renewable power capacity.
But the authors of the report warn that even this record growth is not enough to meet climate targets. The wind industry must install nearly three times as much capacity as it did last year for the next 6 years to do its part.
And as our response to climate change plods along, the impact on ecosystems is not slowing down. Take coral reefs. There's news this week, and it's not good. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, says the world's coral reefs are in the middle of a global bleaching event. Bleaching is caused by warming ocean temperatures, which stress out the reefs and turn them white. David Obura is deeply involved in trying to save coral reefs. He's the founding director of Cordio East Africa, a nonprofit focused on conservation in the Indian Ocean. We reached David at home in Mombasa, Kenya, and he told us why coral bleaching can be so catastrophic for the larger environment.
Bleaching is the corals being stressed, and the corals are the architect of the reef. So if they die because of a bleaching event, then the reef ecosystem loses its architects and engineers. So there's less structure there and less habitat for other species to live in. There's a figure from quite a long time ago that one quarter of marine species are dependent on reefs at some point in their life cycle. So if we lose coral reefs, we do lose one of the most productive and vibrant marine ecosystems that many species and then ultimately people as well are very dependent on.
If we assume that ocean temperatures are going to continue to warm, are we at risk of losing coral reefs entirely?
Yes, we certainly are. If we don't slow down the rate of warming and cap the total amount of warming that we have globally, we will certainly lose coral reefs. I mean, we already have estimated that half of coral reefs have declined or degraded, not just because of warming, but because of pollution and overfishing as well in local areas. But now in the last 10 years, warming has really taken over as the principal threat. You know, the immense heat we've seen in the last year, and they say we're about to cross the 1.5 Celsius warming threshold that is a critical one for large impacts for climate change. If we continue to go way above 1.5 to 2 degrees or 2.5, then we won't be able to retain coral reefs. We really have to cap warming to as low as possible as soon as we can.
This is the fourth time that NOAA, the U.S. science agency, has named a global bleaching event. How significant is that?
Well, it's very significant going into the fourth global bleaching event now. The first one was in 1998, so that's 26 years ago. And then 2010, 2016, there were several years of bleaching, and now we're starting into one now. And what this shows is that the degree of temperature rise and additional heat is ramping up. These events are coming closer together and becoming longer and more intense. And it's a sign of climate change, you know, going beyond boundaries that we really understand. We really don't know when or at what point, you know, massive catastrophic impacts will happen. We have to watch out for that. Coral reefs are a real canary in the coal mine for global warming, and we really need to listen to what's happening and watch what's happening to try and limit this threat to ecosystems globally.
Aside or in addition to capping warming, are there other interventions that can help reefs?
Oh, yeah. So reefs and corals are quite sensitive to many different stresses and pressures, and they'll bleach to because of pollution and sedimentation as well, even because of too cold temperatures. So reducing local pressures is critically important to helping corals deal with the stress and also to regrow afterwards. But unfortunately, the main threat from warming is a global one. And the only way we can really reduce that is to reduce fossil fuel use and carbon dioxide emissions as quickly as we can. There's no technical solutions at the moment that can really do it on the scale that's needed in a viable way and also be safe for other aspects of nature and, you know, other unintended consequences.
I'm curious, you study the Indian Ocean. How have reefs there compared to those in other parts of the globe?
Well, it's very interesting right now because not every region has gone through four events. It varies from place to place. But we were really badly impacted in the first global bleaching event and the earlier ones. And I think what we're seeing now is that the amount of heat that we've experienced here, the temperatures are already declining over the last week or two because of seasonal shifts. So we're at the tail end of the bleaching event here. And it looks like we won't have as big an impact in terms of coral death as has been reported from the Great Barrier Reef or from the Caribbean last year. So I think we got off a little bit better than other regions this time around. But it's partly because we haven't seen quite as much heat, perhaps, as they did, and partly because we've actually already lost most of the sensitive corals in the past, and the corals that are there now are tougher, and they've been able to deal with this event, but we don't know, you know, how well they'll be able to deal with the next one.
So bleached coral reefs, as you have said, can recover and regrow. Is it known exactly, you know, how long a heating event has to go for to prevent a recovery?
So bleaching is like a fever in humans. We get a fever when we're sick or have an infection. And if the infection is not too bad, the fever deals with it and we can recover. But if the infection is really bad, then, you know, our fever can't withstand it and we may die. So that's what happens with bleaching. And during the local summer, the hottest time of the year, if the water is, you know, 1 or 2 degrees Celsius warmer, so that's about 2 or 3 Fahrenheit warmer than it normally is in the summer for about 4 to 8 weeks at a time, then that adds up to too much stress. So the corals will bleach. And if it goes on for much longer than 8 weeks at those high temperatures, then you start to get death of the coral tissue. And then after the mortality, we then have to wait for new corals to come in, baby corals, larval corals to settle in and to start regrowing.
David Obura is the director of Cordio East Africa, a nonprofit focused on conservation in the Indian Ocean. He spoke with us from Mombasa, Kenya.
A final note today about Croatian basketball player Nika Mule. After 4 years with the storied University of Connecticut women's team, she was selected last night in the WNBA draft, signaling the start of her pro career.
With the 14th pick in the 2024 WNBA draft, the Seattle Storm select Nika Mule, University of Connecticut.
We first reported on Mule and other international players earlier this month during March Madness. Listen back to that story and any of our reporting you might have missed. We're at theworld.org, or you will find us wherever you listen to podcasts.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.